Then Juliet Nicholson was saying, which, not Juliet Nicholson, my God, Juliet.
Rosenthal.
Oh, no, this is a terrible thing. I just can't believe you'll ever be able to get her name right again.
Esther, you've already guaranteed her an extra Christmas present.
This is a Christmas nightmare. Her approach is, if that's all very well being very prepared, but you have to, things often go wrong in the moment, or people drive us mad in the moment. And her view is very much, you just have to let it go. And it's really as simple as that. It's very hard to do in the moment, but if you kind of psych yourself up and take a deep breath and say, Juliet Rosenfeld told, who's a psychotherapist, told me, I just have to let it go. Because Christmas is for children. And if you're having a row with someone, it's upsetting for them. And it's really for children, isn't it?
Well, a new Christmas, extra Christmas present for Juliet. And apologies to Times listeners who may have thought that Esther said a rude word there. But I am absolutely sure she didn't. And I also think Santa is going to turn up quite soon. That is it from me today. I'll be back at 1 o'clock tomorrow. But up next on Times Radio, Fee Glover and Roy Anika.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and Roy Anika on Times Radio.
Coming up on our programme today, we'll talk to Israel's former ambassador to Australia about the terror attack at Bondi Beach. What's drawing young British men to the far-right US anti-Semite Nick Fuentes? Lord Sewell will tell us. After the death of the Hollywood director Rob Reiner, we'll pay tribute to him with Hadley Freeman. And our Muppet alert, you've got too much money for your own good story today. We're asking, what is the most you pay for a bowl of chips? I'm going to give you a clue, £14.95. What a bunch of idiots.
But first, the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Strikes by resident doctors in England will go ahead as planned on Wednesday. Members of the British Medical Association have rejected a new offer from the government. It focused on expanding training posts and covering exam fees, but didn't include pay. Health Secretary Wes Streeting says the action is reckless.
The BMA have chosen to strike this week, not only to cause maximum impact and damage to the NHS, but choosing to do so at a time when there is the maximum risk to patients. I think that is irresponsible, and I think it's dangerous.
The family of the man who tackled and disarmed one of the Bondi Beach gunmen say their son is recovering well in hospital. Hundreds of people have laid flowers at the scene of yesterday's attack, where 15 people were killed celebrating Hanukkah. It comes 2.5 months after a synagogue was attacked in Manchester on Yom Kippur. Mark Levy from the Jewish Representative Council of Greater Manchester says the community has been devastated again.
I'm aware of people who live in Manchester who have lost siblings in this latest atrocity. We need to understand what it is that is radicalising individuals to want to use Jewish holidays to perpetrate atrocities.
European leaders are expected to cement their support for Ukraine later in the face of pressure from the US to accept a peace deal. More talks on ending the war with Russia are happening today in Berlin. US Special Envoy Steve Witkoff says a lot of progress was made yesterday when he sat down with President Zelensky. The son of the democracy campaigner Jimmy Lai says he's heartbroken by his father's condition as he faces life in prison in Hong Kong. The 78-year-old media tycoon, who's a British citizen, has already spent more than 1,800 days in solitary confinement. Sebastian Lai says Hong Kong's laws have been manipulated.
In the 800-page verdict that they have, there's essentially nothing. There's nothing that incriminates him. There's nothing, even under their own legal system, would make him guilty. And so this is an example, this is a perfect example of how the national security law has been molded and weaponized against someone who essentially said stuff that they didn't like.
The British government calls it a politically motivated conviction. A court's been shown dashcam footage from the car of the man who drove into more than 100 people at Liverpool's Premier League title parade. Paul Doyle is being sentenced for 31 offences relating to the incident in May. The court heard how the 54-year-old lost his temper and started swearing at pedestrians. Doyle cried as the footage was shown to the court. And Reform UK says it would cut the number of civil servants by around 68,000 if it won the next next election. Danny Kruger says it would make Whitehall a better place to work and save taxpayers £5 billion a year. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. Afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Well, welcome to the afternoon programme. It's 4 minutes past two. A Christmas countdown is definitely on the cards. What might have been in your advent calendar today, Ryanika? I'm thinking that you probably don't have one of those glorious cheap chocolate ones, do you?
I don't have one at all, actually.
What's wrong with you, girlfriend?
I know. I used to have them when I was younger, but they've sort of fallen by the wayside. But if I did have one, it would be some sort of horse-related chocolate.
Would it?
100%.
Okay. Well, that is very good to know. If anyone would like to donate an advent calendar halfway through the month to Ryanika, gosh, that would be generosity, wouldn't it? Then send it to Times Radio. We've got plenty to entertain you on a really, really hard news day, actually, today. And we fully recognise that for many of you, by the time you get to 2 o'clock as well, you definitely need a little bit of the light as well as the shade. So, of course, we will talk about the very serious events from Bondi Beach in a couple of moments' time. We will also talk about the COVID inquiry in this country and hear from a woman whose father died in the first wave of COVID. Were the right questions asked at the inquiry and were the right answers given? But we'll talk about other stuff too. British wool is apparently having its moment. Not since the Tweedy Heights of the last century have woolmakers been so busy. Some of this is apparently down to the TV influence of series like The Gentleman, The Crown and Downton Abbey. But maybe also we've simply had enough of stretchy, cheap fabrics, elasticated waists, bobbling jumpers and clothes that only last one wash. We'll talk about that in this hour of the programme. How expensive would you like your chips to be? There's a fantastic piece in the Times today from Hannah Evans, who's been to the very high-end restaurant in Soho, which only serves chips. House chips are £9 a plate and they go all the way up to £14.95 a plate. And it's not even a very big plate. We're going to talk to a proper fish and chip shop owner. We will also talk today about the legacy left by Rob Reiner and in the literary world by Sophie Kinsella and Joanna Trollope. We'll do that with Alex Clark, and Adam Shaw is here to explain the new horizon of the ISAs post-budget. Now, your favourite Rob Reiner film would be what, Raya?
The Princess Bride.
Why?
Because it's a film I watched when I was young so many times, and every time I returned to it, I laughed a little bit more. I found a new joke that I hadn't discovered before, and Cary Elwes was pretty hot.
And for people who haven't seen that movie, what genre are you placing that in?
Romantic comedy fantasy.
Okay, that's good to know.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wonderful film.
Well, all of your memories of Rob Reiner films, I think it's always a decent thing to do when somebody who's part of our cultural legacy dies. Let's think about all of the amazing films that he participated in front of and behind the camera. I would definitely say When Harry Met Sally, it just has a lasting impression on you, that movie, doesn't it? Not just for, you know, the inevitable scenes in it that, of course,
which ones do you mean,
are great
P?
And stay in your mind, but also just that whole fantastic concept of a movie that's about whether or not you can genuinely be friends between the sexes. We are Jane and Fee at times.radio on the email, and we're 0333 003 2353. Let me just tell you about the most read stories on the Times website so far this afternoon. In at number three, junior doctors vote to go ahead with 5 day strike. In the last hour, BMA Resident Doctors Committee Chair Dr. Jack Fletcher has been speaking about that decision.
So the decision has been a resounding reject of the government's latest offer. It clearly doesn't go far enough to fix this jobs crisis with just repurposed jobs. And also it doesn't do anything to address the long-term pay erosion that doctors have faced in the face of yet more real-terms pay cuts that this government is pushing onto us.
Well, the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, has called the BMA irresponsible.
I offered to postpone these strikes, to reschedule them for January, because of the enormous risks to patients and the NHS at the worst possible time, given the enormous pressures we're seeing and the disruption caused by flu. The BMA have chosen to strike this week, not only to cause maximum impact and damage to the NHS, But choosing to do so at a time when there is the maximum risk to patients, I think that is irresponsible and I think it's dangerous. And even now, if the BMA want to reschedule to January, the government will facilitate that.
That is Wes Streeting talking in the last hour or so. The second most read story on the Times website today: who are the Bondi Beach shooting suspects, Sajid and Naveed Akram? The father and son with alleged links to Islamic State had told their family that they were going fishing for the weekend. And the most read piece on the Times website is Ahmed Al-Ahmed, the Bondi Beach hero. God gave me courage. A video shows the fruit shop owner jumping onto the gunman from behind and taking his firearm in Sydney. He is still recovering from being shot in the shoulder and hand. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You do need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. You can go to thetimes.com/subscribe. And if you do that, there's so much more on offer too. You could give your brain a little bit of a workout with the hundreds of word and number puzzles that are included when you sign up for a digital subscription.
The former Prime Minister and Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, says it wasn't possible to save all jobs during the pandemic. He's been giving evidence at the COVID inquiry today.
I think in that first press conference, or certainly I hope always open, you know, it wasn't going to be possible to save every single person's job, and people were going to experience economic hardship as a result of what was happening. And I thought it was important to be honest with people about that up front. There's a balance. You know, you want to provide reassurance, but I think a degree of candour is also appropriate.
Sunak was behind schemes such as the furlough and Eat Out to help out. Well, I'm joined now by Rivka Gottlieb, a spokesperson for COVID for bereaved families, whose father, Michael, died from COVID during the first lockdown in April 2020. Rivka, welcome to the show and thank you so much. And I'm sorry, so sorry to hear about your father. Can I ask, you have heard, I'm sure, some of Rishi Sunak giving his evidence today to the inquiry. What impact do you think the Chancellor's decisions at the time had on families who were dealing with the pandemic and its consequences?
First of all, thank you for having me. I have not been able to hear Sunak's evidence today. I mean, he's still giving evidence, so I think it's a bit early to comment what he said today, but of course we know what his policies were and what he's done and what his record is, and his previous appearances at the COVID inquiry, where he spent an awful lot of time saying, "I do not recall," when asked telling questions. The most recent module report, module two, which was about the government's decision making in the early days, was pretty damning. And it was critical of him as well as of Boris Johnson. I think he did an absolutely appalling job pretty much on every level. And the Eat Out to Help Out scheme was, in my view, bordering on criminal. We now know that he did not seek scientific advice about that. It was purely an economic decision, completely muddied the messaging that the government was putting out about risk. You know, we were told we weren't supposed to mix indoors together, but, you know, come and eat in restaurants and, you know, we'll help you do that. It was just dreadful. The evidence has since suggested that the scheme was linked to between 8 and 17% of newly detected infection clusters in late summer of 2020. So he promoted a policy that not only contradicted scientific advice, but put lives at risk.
I mean, I appreciate you haven't heard him give answers today, but one of the things that he has been talking, I mean, a lot of what he's been talking about is about, obviously, his policies with regards to the economy. Do you think the government prioritised the economy over people's lives during the pandemic?
I think that was what they were trying to do, but it was a completely false narrative, because it's not... The reality is that controlling the virus was the quickest and most effective way to protect the economy. You know, people who are afraid to go out because they may get sick and die are not going to go out and spend money and go, do you see what I mean? So that, it just made no sense from that point. I don't think the choice really was between public health and the economy. It should have been that the priority should have been to contain the virus properly, and the economy would have suffered less as a result.
I mean, we had Boris Johnson not so long ago giving evidence to the inquiry, and a lot of people are sceptical about just exactly how many questions will be answered. How hopeful are you that the inquiry is actually going to address, properly address, the failure of the government's actions during the pandemic?
It's hard to say at this point. Where this is module 9 that Sunak is giving evidence in today, which is examining the impact of COVID on the economy. There are altogether 10 modules. We've only had reports for two. And the first two reports have both been pretty good and pretty detailed, despite key members of the government at that time not answering questions very openly, shall we say, when questioned. So I think the truth is coming out. And I think the inquiry is doing a good job at identifying what went wrong and is making pretty good recommendations. The question is whether those recommendations will then be implemented. I'm particularly concerned, since we're talking about Rishi Sunak, about the statutory sick pay situation. People were told to isolate if they were ill, but were not given adequate support, financial support, in order to do so. During the pandemic, statutory sick pay was only £94 a week, which is not enough for most people to live on. So I think that that's something that needs to be seriously looked at in recommendations for the future.
One of the things that Sunak was talking about today was he said that in those early stages, there was just he just didn't have the time to panic when making decisions. It was a very fast moving situation. The government had to make very fast decisions. But at the same time, things like Eat Out to Help Out, that was a policy that was introduced in a later stage of the pandemic. Do you feel his referencing there of how fast decisions had to be made justifies any of the decisions that they made, which obviously you think were the wrong ones?
I don't, because the warnings were coming much earlier than the government was making their decisions. In fact, Baroness Hallett in the inquiry in Module 2 identified in her report that February 2020 was a lost month when nothing was done. They had time to make decisions. There was scientific evidence. There wasn't much. It was obviously emerging. Every country was struggling. I'm not saying the situation was easy, not by a long shot, but they could have made better decisions and earlier. That would have cost the country less, both economically and in terms of loss of life.
One of the things that Sunak mentioned today was he was talking about, you know, the various economic support policies. And he said he felt that the support for the most vulnerable was more successful than the government expected. And he said he was proud of it. What do you make of a statement like that?
I think the evidence points in a different direction. I don't think that that is true. And I know that there were a lot of problems with the furlough scheme. I know there was a lot of fraud. That's something else that needs to be tackled. I know that there were a lot of people who were caught between systems, freelancers, for example, or people in 0 hours contract type jobs. It was actually really, really difficult for an awful lot of people. And it's very difficult, I think, for somebody like Rishi Sunak to understand what life can be like for ordinary people. He comes from money and he has never known a day's hardship in his life. And that, I think, is a problem. And he was surrounded by people from similar backgrounds. The government was made up of a very elitist group and they were not listening to the voices of communities and of other people.
Can I ask Rivka just finally, obviously the inquiry is ongoing and will be for quite a long time. For families like yourselves who lost family members during the pandemic, what do you want to see come out of this inquiry? Is it government accountability? Is it more answers to questions? Is it a set of guidelines of things that won't happen again?
It's all of the above, but I think above all, we need to know that these recommendations will actually be implemented. There needs to be a national oversight mechanism, which currently there isn't. We need Hillsborough Law, which is the Public Accountability Bill, and we need it to be implemented in full because that includes a duty of candour and a duty to assist, which currently doesn't exist, which would have made the inquiry process much shorter. It's just been mind-boggling to me, some of the barriers to getting the answers that we need in order to learn from them, in order to be better prepared for any future crisis. We're told it's not if, it's when the next pandemic hits, and we need to be ready.
Well, that's Rivka Gottlieb, a spokesperson for COVID for bereaved families.
Right, many of you have been in touch this afternoon already with your thoughts about the legacy of Rob Reiner. This one in from Glyn. It's always a good day when we know that Glyn is with us. Stand By Me is my favourite Rob Reiner film, based on a brilliant Stephen King short stories. Short story, my apologies. It's my, if you don't like this, I probably won't like you film. And I'm with you on that one, Glyn. It's, do you know it, Roy? It's the most glorious coming of age movie,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, another film that I watched a lot when I was young. Yep. And with an epic soundtrack.
Yes, and also just epic that those four boys were in it, because they all went on to, you know, far greater things. They were good picks at the time, and they went on to be good picks. One of them, though, not long enough. This one comes from Kate, who says, When Harry Met Sally, it's my absolute favourite film. I'm the same age as you, Fee, so it came out at a key time for me. It was actually, wasn't it? It was a really, really key time. If you are currently 56... cusping 57, you'll know exactly what that key time was. For years, Kate says, I watched it every year on my birthday. Thank you for your thoughts about the guests that we just had on the programme talking about the COVID inquiry. And many of you are incredibly sympathetic, as you would be, because you're decent human beings, to anybody who lost family members during COVID. But many of you have different thoughts about the implications of political decisions at the time and everything that is being heard by the inquiry. Nigel says, remember the eat out idea was at the same time as you could go to supermarkets to buy groceries. The criticism is misdirected. And another person listening says, it's very easy to be clever years after an event. At the time, all parties wanted speed. Sorry, that's from Ian. I didn't catch your name there at the bottom. We will take all of your thoughts, all of your opinions. As ever, we are 0333 003 2353. Coming up, now this is a question I don't think many of you thought that you'll be asked this afternoon. Do you have an answer to it? I don't know. Who's been the unexpected rescuer of modern British wool? You're listening to Fee Glover and Roy Nika on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Hugo Rifkind, tomorrow morning from 10 on Times Radio.
Prepare for a lively mix of illuminating conversation.
Is it just me that strikes me there's a whiff of nonsense about the deal?
Quality journalism, analysis and opinion that speaks for itself.
Even while it drags on and as horrifying as it is, it should have been a foreign policy triumph.
Plus unique perspectives on the day's news.
There seems to be a theme here, and that is that no one knows what's going on.
Hugo Rifkind, tomorrow morning from 10 on Times Radio.
I am so looking forward to Christmas. I absolutely love everything about it. Decorating the tree, wrapping the presents. For us, it's always been a big family get-together. Me, Mike, the kids, my sister Julie, and all her family too. We all go back home to Mum and Dad's house. It's a bit of a squeeze these days, but Mum and Dad are both in their 80s now, and it's really important that we all go where we've always gone for Christmas. It just wouldn't be the same any other way. Thankfully, this year we have Carol, Mum and Dad's lovely care professional from Home Instead. Home Instead are amazing. I honestly don't know what we'd do without them. Carol comes and visits in the week when we're all busy at work and makes sure that Mum and Dad have everything they need. Obviously, this year we've all offered to help with preparing the Christmas dinner, but Mum absolutely insists that she's got it all under control. Which means Carol has.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio. Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix, kitchens and bathrooms. Helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
It's 22 minutes past two. Britain might be struggling on a few fronts, but on one, we stand alone. We stand very tall and proud. When it comes to British actors clad in immaculate tailoring, striding across your screen on the latest streaming hit, we absolutely nail it. Think The Gentleman, Peaky Blinders, The Crown, and then there's Claudia and her fabulous, although possibly quite itchy outfits, and Traitors. The Netflix effect could be rescuing wool in the UK. Is this just a headline created by Netflix itself? Or is there more to this PR yarn? I can hear the groan. Let's talk to British Wool's Director of Marketing, Graham Clark. I absolutely promise you, Graham, there are no more unravelling puns in this interview. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. And we're used to puns, don't worry about
it. Yeah,
that.
I bet you are, so I'll park them. Tell us a bit more about the story of British wool over recent times.
Sure. So we, as British Wool, we work on behalf of about 30,000 sheep farmers across the UK. So we sell on behalf of farmers the vast majority of wool. And prices, as of late, in the past 2 or 3 months, have really increased quite substantially. And they're at the highest level now they've been for 9 years. So really going in the right direction.
And do you buy into this notion that some of that is because displayed across our screens and therefore across the world are actually some very, very fine examples of where British wool ends up?
It certainly doesn't do any harm. I think when people see wool on the screen, it stops it feeling old-fashioned and it feels more contemporary and aspirational, so people want to buy into that. So, yeah, it's a small percentage. There are a lot of things going on in the background as well. So one of the big drivers is there's more and more brands using British wool in their products. So there's more choice for consumers when they're looking for more eco-friendly products. Mm-hmm. And there is a big drive for many consumers now to be looking for that sort of eco-conscious products as opposed to going down a fast fashion, plastics, destroying the environment kind of angle.
For sure. How do we know then, Graham, that we are buying British wool in a product?
So we've got a distinctive logo, so it's a shepherd's crook mark. So that is displayed on all of the products, whether they're sold online or in a physical retailer. So if consumers look for the shepherd's crook mark, they'll know they're buying British wool. They'll also know they're supporting rural communities, so our farmers, but also supporting the environment as well, because wool is one of the most environmentally friendly fibres known to man. Mm.
So tell us a little bit more about that, because I'm sure, you know, we can all understand that wool is a very pure product and it's not going to contain microplastics or some horrible kind of slinky yuck on top of it. But in terms of the process of getting wool off the sheep and ending up as an item of clothing that we would wear, how environmentally safe is that whole supply chain?
It's environmentally safe, and it's also getting better as well. There's been a lot of investment in wool processing down the past, past 5 years or so. So there is a big push towards making it even more environmentally friendly. It's so much better than synthetics. It's so much better at every single stage. So there are quite a lot of different processing that wool needs when it comes off the back of a sheep. But it's nowhere near the carbon footprint that something like a synthetic garment would have.
Right.
Also, sorry.
No, carry on.
I was just going to say wool also lasts longer. So if you purchase a wool garment, it's likely to last you for many, many years to come and can also be handed down as well. It doesn't date, so a nice tweed jacket, as you've seen on sort of the Gentleman, Peaky Blinders, those kind of programmes, they look great and it can be styled in many, many different ways.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to be careful how you clean the things though, haven't you, Graham? I mean, I don't think anybody, certainly who's been through family life, has not had the episode where you put a beautiful woolen jumper into a washing machine and out comes something that even your teddy bear can't get into.
I think it's just following the instructions. You just follow the instructions.
What are you saying, Graham? Are you saying I can't follow instructions here?
Heavens forbid, no. Wouldn't dream of it. I think one thing on wool as well, it doesn't need to be cleaned as often as other products as well. It's got self-cleaning properties. Obviously, if you spill tomato ketchup down the front of it, then it's going to need cleaning. But just generally speaking, a good air will give it that clean because of its natural fibre.
Right. Properties. Now, that is an interesting thing. I think that message should be amplified, shouldn't it? Because apart from anything else, we wash our clothes too much, full stop, don't we?
Way too much. And they emit microplastics into the ocean. And, you know, David Attenborough and programmes such as that have really highlighted what damage we're doing to the planet that we all live on. Well, if you do wash well, it doesn't emit microplastics or harmful ones anyway. They just dissolve in the ocean naturally. So we shouldn't be washing things as often. It's not good. Not good for the environment and also not good for clothes as well.
There is a royal link to British wool as well, isn't there?
Very much so. So King Charles is the patron of the Campaign for Wool. So the Campaign for Wool is an overriding promotional organisation that works with all wool growing nations. So there's ourselves, Australia, New Zealand and South Africa. And we all come together to promote how amazing wool is, to try and get more and more consumers looking for wool, purchasing wool and driving demand. And also you know, having a better footprint for themselves as well.
We started off our conversation talking about what life is like for the farmers who are actually keeping the sheep from where we get the wool. And would you say that now they can definitely look to a more secure future, Graham?
So the wool price has been challenging. We're not going to get any arguments from that over the past few years. With wool prices where they are at the moment, there is still some distance to go till we get to where we need to be for farmers to be making a profit on their wool. But it's certainly moving in the right direction. It's a lot better than it was 12 months ago. So it's certainly moving in the right direction.
Now, I'm going to ask you this question. Don't think that I'm being frisky, but what are you wearing today, Graham?
Wool, obviously.
Are you? Okay, it looks a little bit like a polyester fleece to me.
It's not a polyester fleece, it's a British wool jumper.
Is there a special kind of electric fence when you walk into headquarters that goes off if there's any polyester? Yeah, I bet
Well, one thing we have done recently is I should have wore it to be fair, but a Christmas jumper. So we've made a lovely Christmas jumper out of British wool, and it's all for Save the Children. So it's quite a really nice hookup with Save the Children, but also Christmas jumpers, you know, fast fashion and people wearing them once and then discarding them. We wanted to do one that would last for many, many years to come.
Well, that sounds like a very sensible thing. Final question. Helen has asked, any alpaca wool? Do you also represent the alpaca farmers?
No, we don't. We purely just handle sheep's fleeces. We don't handle alpaca. There are companies in the UK that do sell alpaca and handle alpaca. And if your caller wants to drop us a line, I'm sure we can put them in touch with somebody.
Sure. Lovely to talk to you, Graham. Thank you very much indeed. We wish you a very Merry Christmas. That's Graham Clark, who is British Wool's Director of Marketing. And that's Ryan, fresh on the button.
Now, why does the US far right appeal to young British men? We'll find out after the news with Laura Kirk.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Resident doctors in England are going ahead with strikes from Wednesday after the British Medical Association rejected a new offer from the government. Health Secretary Wes Streeting says the action just before Christmas will inflict damage on the NHS at the moment of maximum danger. He's already warned so-called superflu is sweeping the nation. Matthew Taylor from the NHS Confederation says the walkout is devastating news for the health service.
If senior members of staff, consultant colleagues have to go down to, for example, the emergency department or general medical ward because resident doctors aren't there, that means they're not undertaking operations or they're not undertaking outpatient appointments. That adds to the waiting list.
The man who tackled one of the Bondi Beach terrorists has been described as a hero of Australia by his parents. Ahmed Al-Ahmed's father says his son has an impulse to protect people after previously serving with the police. A court's heard a man who drove into more than 100 people during Liverpool's Premier League title parade in May lost his temper. Paul Doyle is being sentenced after pleading guilty to 31 offences. Sir Cliff Richard has revealed he's been treated for prostate cancer in the last year. The 85-year-old singer's joined calls for a national screening programme. And research has found Christmas chocolates are more expensive and much smaller than they were 5 years ago. Analysts looked at tubs of roses, celebrations and heroes for the study. They're blaming the soaring price of both cocoa and sugar for the shrinkflation. And for a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
This is Times Radio.
Discover Adelaide in South Australia, where culture, cuisine and natural beauty come together effortlessly. Sip world-class wines in the Barossa, stroll pristine beaches just minutes from Adelaide, spot wildlife in abundance on Kangaroo Island, and explore the magic of the Flinders Ranges and Outback. Fly to Adelaide on the new Emirates A350. Enjoy superior service and comfort in economy class, premium economy or the refined business class. Book today at emirates.com.
What good is sitting alone?
Winning a record-breaking 7 Olivier Awards, Cabaret at the Kit Kat Club is still the best musical in London, says the Daily Telegraph.
Life is a cabaret, chum.
The most electrifying night out starts the minute you step inside. Outside it is winter, but in here it is so hot. So right this way, your stage side table is waiting. Book your tickets for a perfectly marvellous gift this Christmas at kitkat.club.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms. Wickes local design experts are ready to help. Whether you start with an in-store design consultation or with a free home measure, it's completely up to you. Find out more about the free design service at wickes.co.uk.
Earlier in the year, Helen learnt that Queen Victoria donated some of her alpaca wool to the now-closed mill in Saltaire, which produced 18 miles of woolen fabric a day, really soft and mixed with sheep wool. And this in from Dominic, who says, "Hello, Fee. Hello, Roy. I think my girlfriend is currently saving the wool industry. Half-finished socks and jumpers everywhere, running up to Christmas. She even goes to a thing called Woolfest. Although, why would they not call it Woolstock?" It's a very good point, Dominic. They've missed an opportunity there. John Pienaar takes over from us at four. Hello, John. How are you?
Hello. So, West Reading is coming on in the 5 o'clock hour of the programme, and his relationship with the BMA, the Doctors' Union, has gone from being scratchy to being deeply hostile. What it's like today, I guess we can only imagine. They've obviously, as we've been reporting, said they're going to go on with the Christmas strikes, and who knows for how long after that. I mean, at this stage, it looks like total deadlock. Months and months of this may be in prospect. But I'm talking to Streeting and also to the BMA and yet their side of the story. They're meeting in Berlin about Ukraine. Keir Starmer, who's, as I speak, is in Westminster taking questions from MPs. He's going to be off to Berlin for the Ukraine conference. So looking at that, but more particularly, we got the heads of the British military and MI6 together warning of the threat from Russia. You know, these warnings keep on coming, now thick and fast. They are deeply, deeply chilling, maybe not chilling enough, given the scale of the threat they're describing. But the question is, then, what do you do about this? I mean, what are they, if they're telling us we need to be worried and act, what should we do that is not being done? I've been talking just a short while ago to Jimmy Lai, the son of the poor man who's now in custody in Hong Kong, facing a life sentence, a media leader.
Sebastian Lai.
Yeah. Sebastian Lai is Jimmy Lai's son. And he told me about the poor condition of his father. It's really, really sad. And just, again, pushing for some sort of help for his father. How on earth that can achieve what he wants it to achieve, I don't know, but yep. It sort of tears your heart.
And it just seems so unlikely that there is ever going to be any movement in the opposite direction on that story, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, he's just become this figurehead for a whole movement that China just wants to shut down, and a life sentence for an ill man who's 78 is just a dreadful, dreadful thing.
It's awful. And the judiciary in Hong Kong just passed down that sentence. There are still two British judges in the highest court in Hong Kong, by the way. I mean, Jonathan Sumption resigned as a high-ranking judge, and there are still two there. And Jimmy Lai is not especially complimentary towards them. He's not rude, he's not abusive, but have a listen. You'll find that interesting. And just lastly, because it's Christmas and because he was up for a chat, we got the man who's the voice of Paddington on stage.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, that sounds good, John. Thank you very much indeed. John Pienaar takes over from us at 4 o'clock this afternoon, so don't miss that opportunity to hear from the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, after 5 o'clock here on Times Radio.
Now, how do you counter someone who is a racist, a misogynist, and an anti-Semite? You could expose them, hold them up to mainstream criticism and ridicule, prove in open debate their ideas are ludicrous. But what if they revel in those labels? And when you point out their hateful nature, they and their fans embrace it. Well, one such figure is Nick Fuentes, who's increasingly the face of the American far right. The conservative peer, Tony Sewell, has written for The Times about the challenge Fuentes poses to the liberal order and why he appeals to so many young men, including here in the UK. And Lord Sewell joins me now. What do you think, Lord Sewell, makes a racist, misogynist, anti-Semite so appealing to so many people?
You know what? I don't even think it's... I think we're almost asking the wrong question here, because it's... We can always go into this debate and say, oh, it's like the Andrew Tate thing. You know, here are just a group of young men who just are terrible and we should condemn them. But I actually think it's much more profound than that. I think what's going on here is the conditions that have brought this about. And for me, I think that in Britain, we've just decided that we're not going to go there when it comes to the conditions of particularly white boys. And for years, we've decided to ignore their plight. And almost they've ignored their own plight, really, in a sense, because in education, in employment, mental health, all of those parameters, they're scoring the worst. And yet at the same time, if they complain, if they suggest that the world is against them, then they're the ones who are condemned as far right and racist. And I think so we've got this sort of strange sort of dilemma where we kind of have a group that's finding, in a sense, people like Nick Fuentes attractive, but at the same time, when they did, and then anybody stood up for them, they were immediately kind of labelled racist, particularly racist and fascist. Mm. I think that was the thing. And I found that particularly when I did my own report on racial disparities and found that, in fact, it was that white group that was performing the worst. And yet there was a massive pylon from just very reasonable people who thought that you shouldn't say that, that you almost couldn't breach that kind of taboo that white boys were actually coming up the worst in terms of all our metrics. And it was kind of that. Now, you imagine if you're a white boy in Hartlepool and in fact, a group of ethnic minority scholars and commentators find that, in fact, your group is performing the worst. And then the whole media come against you for that. How would you feel? You know?
Mm.
And I think that's so to me, I think that we've got a lot to answer for. And in fact, the chickens or whatever is coming home to roost, as they say. And I think that's what we've got at the moment. You know, they will go to a place where and people will take advantage when there is this space that we've created. And I think that that's the dilemma that we face at the moment.
Now, Nick Fuentes has already got considerable traction and a sizable following in America. Have you seen support for him growing here in the UK?
Not really. But what I have seen is a sort of sense that I don't know what the traction, what the numbers are, but there certainly is an interest in that kind of podcasting, and I'm not surprised. And in fact, to be honest, I always think that in fact our young men have been quite restrained, given I think the stuff that's come against them. And I say young men, I say specifically white young men, and I say restrained in the sense that, you know, everything I think media wise. I mean I would never. And I have a PhD and whatever. I've gone through, I've taught at universities. There is no way on this planet that I would advise many young men to go to any of our top universities to study.
Why?
Terrible. It would be a terrible place to go for them. But first of all, you're going to go in there. What's the numbers here? We're talking about, you're probably about 15% of the population, if that. Mm. Certainly hardly any of, and certainly if you're from a poor background, you're going to be, there's going to be hardly any of you there. Secondly, I think that the kind of curriculum, I mean, my own subject, English in history, you'll be taught totally to feel ashamed of your background. You'll be told that you're white privilege. You're told that your ancestors, in fact, enslaved my ancestors. So you're responsible for that. You've got a student union that will be totally against you because you're white. I mean, the whole space would be terrible. Probably better off trying to get a plumbing job or something like that. But don't forget those universities. They're, you know, and I think that it would be, in some ways, we've just allowed this beast to kind of grow and actually just been totally indifferent to it. And I think that, those universities, those courses, and I've looked at them, lots of them, have no positive thing to say about working class white men in this country.
I mean, we've seen the effect that Andrew Tate has on so many boys and young men. It's well documented. Why do you think characters like him and Nick Fuentes are so appealing to so many young men? What is it about them that is the particular draw, you think, that you found in your research and your report?
Yeah, I mean, school. I mean, I can't think now of every area from watching television to school to going to university, every area, I think every aspect of life, if you're a white male walking around, it wasn't always like this. And we're not talking about something to do with just, I mean, they're not even, you know, if you look at it, they're not even a protective characteristic. And if you look at the numbers that are around them, every other group is getting protected here, except them. They're considered the dangerous group. So to me, it's obvious, and they're not. That's the reality. They only become danger because, in a sense, there's nowhere else for them to go. So if you're creating a society, you're creating a world where you've alienated this group. And it's not so surprising. It's not even Andrew Tate. It's actually even more so. I think it's just a sense of sitting at home and feeling really isolated.
But Tony, can I just jump in here? I mean, isn't one of the reasons why young white men don't have any of those things as a protected characteristic? Because they simply don't need it. They've not been bottom of the pile. History will tell you that a certain platform of privilege is available to you simply because you are a young white man.
Listen, I in the column, if you write, I made an analogy. I linked this to Dickens, and I linked this to the 19th century poor white boys that were in the 19th century. Look, we're talking about poor white, low-income boys, and that's essentially we're talking about. They have no privilege. You know, their perception they might have. You tell me what privilege some poor white boy in Hartlepool who goes to a rundown comprehensive, no work, nothing going.
Sure, but no, I think the troubling thing, Tony. Though I completely accept that. But I think the problem that an awful lot of people have with those who follow Andrew Tate and Nick Fuentes is they are not in that category. They are not poor white boys who are suffering from a bad education, will leave school with no job prospects simply because of where they were born. You know, the level of support for Nick Fuentes and Andrew Tate is quite often in a much, much higher socioeconomic part of our community. Men who really...
Why are you concerned about those two? What you should be concerned about are the reasons behind it. So you go... These are really going to be the symptoms.
Because I want some young men to just take responsibility for themselves, Tony. You know, I sometimes struggle with the notion that they don't have choice, because they do have a choice. They're just making a choice, you know, that is really bad.
It's quite interesting you say that. I think I absolutely agree that the whole notion of responsibility should be there. And I'm definitely one for agency. I've spoken to that about the situation, particularly for black boys as well. There's a lot of choices, a lot of things going. However, I think that there comes a point where, in fact, when you see the narrative stacked up against them, nobody's really, they're not really going out moaning at all, you know. I mean, I'm one moaning for them. No, I don't. They're not going on the street saying, "Oh, woe is me." They're actually just in their bedrooms playing games. So they're not really a problem. They're not really saying, "Oh, you know, the world is against me." So, you know, in fact, they need more people to say that. You know, it's the opposite.
Tony, can I ask? There's a lot of debate around whether or not the likes of Fuentes and Andrew Tate should be given platform or no one should interview them, no one should hear them speak. In this world of free speech, there is a debate around every time we hear from someone like him. Piers Morgan has just had him on his show. Are people either drawn more towards what he's saying or turned off from his rhetoric? What are your thoughts on that?
I think these things will increase, but I think they'll increase more if we don't address the issues that those boys are presenting to us. They need a new narrative. They need a positive narrative about themselves. They need an education system that is really going to link towards their needs. They also need for us to begin to kind of understand that they are not closet racist, fascist, right wing. If they complain that there are things that are against them in their communities, they have the legitimate questions about mass immigration. They have the legitimate issues about grooming gangs. They have legitimate issues to express about being boys in perhaps a feminized school context. All these things are legitimate, and we can't just shut them down. If you shut them down, then these other people will come out, and they will come out, and they will be the voices, and they will be the followers. So I think our society just got to come to terms now with this reality and start saying, well, look, there, you know, this is a group that we've got to take serious. And yes, they do need to. They do need some protection here.
Well, one of our listeners, Mary, has messaged in to say, please tell Lord Sewell his piece was brilliant. And you can read that with your Times subscription. It's on today. That was Lord Sewell, the Conservative peer.
We'd love your thoughts. We're 0333 003 2353. Coming up, we're going to change gear slightly. What's the most you'd pay for some chips? You're listening to Fee Glover and Ryan Neeker on Times Radio with Wix. It's 12 minutes to 3. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
An awful lot going on this week. We'll bring you all the latest news from around the world, from Berlin to Bondi.
We'll get the latest unemployment statistics and PIP numbers, and we'll talk about what it means for the government and bringing down the welfare bill.
And one of our favourite things to do on any day, talking through the stories with William Hague and Kezia Dickdale.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Listen at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
My granddad says the best Christmas gift isn't always something you can unwrap, like an investment with Aberdeen Investment Trust. I might not get excited about it now, but he says one day I might just realise how thoughtful it was. Something to help build my future. He says Aberdeen offer lots of investment opportunities and he hopes I'll thank him when I grow up. Search Aberdeen Investment Trust to find out more. When investing, please remember that your capital's at risk.
Same.
Ho, ho, ho!
Same.
3, 2, 1!
Same.
Whoa! Thanks.
Same.
What does Santa call his dog?
Same. Same.
One word. Three syllables.
Same. Same.
Sorry, it's a bit dry.
New plates.
Ooh.
Treat your table to something different this Christmas. Visit your local IKEA now. IKEA, the wonderful everyday.
This is Times Radio.
Well, quite a response to Roy's interview there with Lord Sewell. I will just run through the first four that have come in on our roller deck of messages. Mitch says, your guest is saying if you don't want young men listening to Tate and Fuentes, more reasonable people need to speak to young men. This one comes in from Peter. Absent fathers must be made to take responsibility too. Gareth says, I'm a working class boy from Hartlepool and I take exception to this highlighting of Hartlepool as a place for non-thinking young white men. There is an exclamation mark after that. And this one comes in saying, the ill-informed guy trashing universities needs to be corrected. His views appear to have come entirely from the right. If you must have these less than 1% views, please balance this up with someone with at least 1 foot in reality. This is nothing less than making things up to try and divide society at a time when we need to pull together. We take all of your views, 0333 003 2353. So very, very sad news out of America about the death of Rob Reiner. This is part of a police investigation and there simply isn't very much else that we're able to tell you at the moment about how he died. But it is definitely an opportunity and it's our responsibility, really, isn't it, to look back at an incredible run of his films. Here we go.
You're not taking him. Nobody's taking him.
Come on, kid, just give me the gun before you take your foot off. You ain't got the sack to shoot a woodchuck.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
Stonehenge, where the demons dwell, where the banshees live.
What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
He didn't fall? Inconceivable.
You keep using the word. I don't think it means what you think it means.
I came here tonight because when you realize you want to spend the rest of your life with somebody, you want the rest of your life to start as soon as possible.
You see? That is just like you, Harry. You say things like that and you make it impossible for me to hate you. And I hate you, Harry. I really hate you.
Well, what a fantastic tribute to a life lived in Hollywood that truly delivered. You heard excerpts from Stand By Me, A Few Good Men, Spinal Tap, which he starred in, The Princess Bride, which is Roya's favourite, and When Harry Met Sally as well. Thank you very much indeed to Ryan for putting that together so beautifully. To Rosie! Oh my God, I gave a white man an advantage. Okay, what's the most you'd pay for chips? £3, £5, what counts as pushing the boat out? The Times reports some Londoners could be forking out £8.95 for a simple unadorned portion. It would be at a new Soho chip emporium named, I can't say this properly, your accent's bound to be better.
Atelier.
Oh, thank God you're here. Only one thing is on the menu. Joining us to give his reaction is John Evans, who is owner of Jojo's Fish and Chips in Stafford. John, very good afternoon from us. Is this bonkers?
Hi, good afternoon, Fee. Yeah, did take me by surprise when I first read it. It's a significant price as well, but the nation does love chips. There's a price point in every business, and it's quite hard in business nowadays with all the costs. But £8.95 for about 300 grams of chips or less seems quite high to me.
Yes, okay. What do you charge?
So for a bigger portion, about 360, 380 grams, we charge £3.60. They're potatoes that we buy from Cambridge or Lincolnshire. We peel them, chip them, get them ready every morning on our premises, and then we cook them and we sell them £3.60.
Okay. So I completely take your point that every business has a different series of things to consider when they are pricing up. I mean, this is a restaurant that's opened in Soho. I imagine that will be an incredibly expensive place to be.
Yeah, for sure. It'd be a bit different to Stafford, but we can relate with costs even in Stafford. The wages, liabilities that we have to pay, everything we need to produce those £3.60 chips, the packaging, etc. The costs are just elevating all the time. I can't imagine what Soho charge, but I'm sure it's a pretty number.
I'm sure it is too. Who does the best chips? I mean, we like to kind of claim this as our national dish, don't we? Fish and chips. But you know, when you go abroad, do people laugh at that notion? Are there other countries that think they're king of chips?
Yeah, there's a big presence in Holland and Belgium. There's in the article you can see it's on every corner. They're selling Fritz. I think Jojo's would give them a run for their money. I'm a potato nut. We're currently buying a variety called Agria, growing in our country by our farmers, and it's a delicious chip. It's the best chip I can buy at the moment, and it's a main season crop, so it will see me going all the way to about May time, and it's a fabulous chip. It's golden in colour. The potatoes are the right size to get the perfect size chips. We cut 14 by 17 mil in our business. It's a bit of a chunky chip, but they cook better and they're very, very popular.
Right, give us the name again.
Agria.
Of the variety, yeah. Agria.
Agria, okay. And
Agria.
Can your domestic person buy this, or is that only going to be available to people like yourself?
So the quality is mainly in wholesale, but yes, you can source them. You might need to go direct to a farm to get them, but maybe in Waitrose you might find them. But right. Agria, Marquee, Sagita, maybe a little bit of Morris Piper, they're very popular chipping varieties. One thing I noticed about the Soho business is they're sourcing them from America. I thought, wow.
Oh, no, that's terrible.
We're surrounded by potato fields.
We
and
are.
You've got wonderful Cambridge, wonderful Lincolnshire, these great growers producing these fantastic chips. And when I read that, I thought,
bit off that.
Well, that's just wrong. Let's call it for what it is. That's absolutely wrong, John. Will you give us a couple of other quick tips on how to cook our chips? Should you soak the potatoes first? Should you be drying them? What kind of oil? You tell us your top tips.
Yeah, so we use market-leading oil. So it's a veg oil. You fry it at a good temperature, about 182 degrees. Some chip shops like to blanch the chips where they'll cook them for a period at a lower temperature, around the 140 mark. Then they will blast them in a hotter oil to finish them off, and that's a blanching method. You do get a very crisp chip from that, but our business, we cook straight through. So we're 182 degrees, and we cook the potato all the way through to finish. I think they create the perfect chip, crispy on the outside, fluffy on the inside. Potatoes, they are a living, they're still living in the bag, so you've got to treat them well. They need to be at the right temperature. If they go below 5 degrees, they suffer. You don't want bruising, so you need to handle them right. And they do need a wash and a dry period. So we will peel masses of potatoes every morning. We then need to wash them through to get the excess starch off them. And then we need them to dry for about 30 minutes before they go near the oil. Water and oil, they don't mix, and it has an effect on the chip at the end.
Okay. These are fantastic tips, and it is absolutely lovely to talk to you, John. Thank you very much indeed. So John Evans is the owner of Jojo's Fish and Chips in Stafford. Get yourselves there if you're in the area. And a delightful comment comes in from Chris, who says, I remember the time when chips were as cheap as chips. It's genius.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online, and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
It's 3 o'clock and you're listening to Fee Glover and Warrenika on Times Radio. Coming up in the next hour, we'll cover the anti-Semitic terror attack at Bondi Beach. Our guest is the former Israeli ambassador to Australia. After the death of Rob Reiner, we'll pay tribute to the director with the Sunday Times' Hadley Freeman. We'll open the doors of our literary salon and talk books at 5:30. And we'll tell you everything you need to know about ICES after the budget shake-up. First, Laura Cook has the headlines.
Thank you. Good afternoon. A resident doctor strike in England in the run-up to Christmas is set to go ahead as planned on Wednesday. The British Medical Association's rejected a new offer from the government, which has called the move irresponsible and dangerous. The five-day walkout comes as officials warn of superflu sweeping the nation. Health Secretary Wes Streeting says the action is reckless.
The BMA have chosen to strike this week, not only to cause maximum impact and damage to the NHS, but choosing to do so at a time when there is the maximum risk to patients. I think that is irresponsible, and I think it's dangerous.
Australia plans to toughen gun laws after the anti-Semitic terrorist attack on Bondi Beach, which left 15 dead and dozens wounded. The Cabinet said stronger laws, which came into force after a mass shooting in Tasmania in 1996, would be renegotiated with the states and territories. John McTiernan, who was former Director of Communications for Julia Gillard when she was Australian Prime Minister, he told Times Radio there's a balance to be struck on gun control.
Guns have a special role in Australian culture in that it's a country with a huge outback. It's a country in which hunting does go on. And, you know, it's a country with a huge rural landscape with farmers who will need to use guns. There is a balance to be struck here, but there's no doubt that in all forms of terrorism, interdicting the supply chain that gets the weapons or the materials to the individuals is a key part of trying to frustrate their plots.
The new head of MI6 is warning that the front line is everywhere, with Moscow's use of hybrid warfare like disinformation, sabotage and cyber attacks. Blaise Metrivelli is the first female boss of MI6. In her first public speech, she'll say Putin will continue his export of chaos until he's forced into a rethink. Christopher Steele ran the Russia desk of MI6 between 2006 and 2009. He explains why the threat from Russia needs to be taken so seriously.
Now the US is making overtures to Russia and effectively cultivating some sort of reset of its relationship with Putin's regime. That Britain stands out now, I think, as the most solid opponent of Russia and Russia's agenda, and particularly in regard for support to Ukraine. So the Britain, whether we like it or not, the UK will become a major priority target for Russia over the coming years.
A court has heard a man lost his temper during Liverpool's Premier League title parade and used his vehicle as a weapon by driving it into more than 100 people. Paul Doyle is at Liverpool Crown Court for a two-day sentencing hearing after pleading guilty to 31 offences relating to seriously injuring people during the event in May. And police in LA are investigating the deaths of the director Rob Reiner and his wife Michelle as suspicious. They're believed to be the two people found dead at his home. Hollywood stars have been paying tribute to Mr. Reiner, who directed films like This is Spinal Tap, When Harry Met Sally and The Princess Bride. The Times' chief film critic Kevin Mayer says his influence is understated.
There's no Richard Curtis without Harry Met Sally. There's no Four Weddings without Harry Met Sally. This is Spinal Tap. That's his. There's no The Office without Spinal Tap. There's no Sacha Baron Cohen without Spinal Tap. You know, it's completely crazy.
And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
It is 4 minutes past three. In this hour of the programme, we'll talk more about the life and times of Rob Reiner. We're going to talk about books as well. And it was a very sad week for the literary community and the readers of Sophie Kinsella and Joanna Trollope last week with news of their deaths. We will talk about that with Alex Clark. And we're going to end the show at about 4:15 by telling you everything that you need to know about the new horizon for ISAs. If you're confused about how much money you'll be able to put into a cash ISA or a stocks and shares ISA from next year onwards, then Adam Shaw is the man who's going to explain everything to you. We're going to start, though, with talking about what happened in Bondi Beach over the weekend. And the latest is that we know 15 people were killed in the terror attack. The gunmen have been named in local media as Sajid Akram and his son Naveed. Keir Starmer has denounced the attack as anti-Semitic. In the last hour, he told MPs at the liaison committee that the incident was clearly not isolated and vowed to support the Jewish community in the UK.
It was an appalling anti-Semitic terror attack that took place yesterday, and I'm sure I speak for the whole committee and the whole House, in fact the whole country, in saying our thoughts are with those affected by this attack. It has impacted not just in Australia but across the globe, and it has impacted on Jewish communities here in the United Kingdom that I know feel even more insecure today than they did before. Yesterday I was in touch with the Australian Prime Minister. I was also in touch with the CST and the Home Office and had a call with the Chief Rabbi last night, partly out of reassurance but also to talk about our plans for Hanukkah events taking place here in the United Kingdom and to make sure that every consideration is given to the security of those events. This is clearly not an isolated incident, and these incidents are chillingly focused on some of the holiest days in the Jewish calendar. And, of course, we have in our minds Heaton Park here in the United Kingdom in October. And I want to reassure our Jewish communities here in the United Kingdom that we will take every step that we can, use all of our powers to make sure they're safe and secure as they should be.
Well, that's Keir Starmer talking in front of the liaison committee. Australia's Prime Minister has said there's no evidence that the attackers were part of a wider terror cell, but that they were clearly motivated by extremist ideology. He described the attack as pure evil.
What we saw yesterday was an act of pure evil, an act of anti-Semitism, an act of terrorism on our shores in an iconic Australian location, Bondi Beach, that is associated with joy, associated with families gathering, associated with celebrations. And it is forever tarnished by what has occurred last evening.
That's Anthony Albanese, co-chief executive of the Executive Council of Australian Jewry. Alex Rivchin was meant to be speaking at the Hanukkah event before the shooting happened. He spoke to Times Radio.
It's an event I've spoken at for the last probably 10 years. And by the grace of God, I wasn't there this year. It was my daughter's best friend's bat mitzvah. And I was speaking to the rabbi just in the hours before, trying to work out a slot in the run sheet that would allow me to do both. But in the end, I declined. And I've recently learned that rabbi, who's a very, very dear friend of mine, was amongst the murdered. So it's something that's absolutely devastating on a personal level and for the community and for the country. This will transform us.
Well, let's talk now to Mark Sofer, who was the Israeli ambassador to Australia from 2017 until 2020. Mark Sofer, a very good afternoon from us. You have so much experience in the country. I wonder, when you were there, whether you ever imagined that something like this might happen.
Well, not at all, not in the least. Australia has always been the paradigm of multiculturalism, the paradigm of tolerance. And what we've seen, though, over the past few years is that either we were mistaken in presenting it as such, or that the situation has deteriorated to such an extent that anti-Semitism has reared its ugly head. Of course, this was the worst manifestation of it yesterday. But to be honest, we've seen it over the last 2 years on an almost incessant basis there in Australia. Synagogues have been torched. Jews have been attacked in the streets, Jewish restaurants have been ransacked, etc. So clearly something shocking is going on in Australia, and I don't think it's confined just to there.
Do you believe that the Australian government has got something quite wrong here?
Well, I think no government in any country in the world, incidentally, and I stress this strongly, including in Israel, can be absolved of responsibility when a major massacre occurs on its soil. Clearly something has gone wrong. Either the intelligence services didn't know what was going on, or the police reaction wasn't strong enough, or that there was not enough forcefulness placed by the government on previous acts of anti-Semitism in the country. So, yes, I think that the government of Australia does have something to answer for, certainly, in the same way as I think, incidentally, that the government of Israel has something to answer for strongly for the 7th of October. There's no difference in principle there. However, I do think that there's an atmosphere around which is conducive to this type of horror, to this type of attack, to this type of tragedy that we saw, and the incessant hate demonstrations, is not the word for it, which go on in the UK as well, unfortunately, but certainly also in Australia and elsewhere, with slogans calling for globalizing the Intifada from the river to the sea, which basically means the eradication of the world's only Jewish state. Issues like that and statements like that are not condemned enough. They are not thrown out as they should be immediately from public discourse, and they continue unabated. And this is, I think, an atmosphere which is conducive to crazed lunatics to carry out what they carried out yesterday.
Sure. So, Mark Sofer, we can hear some of your desire to distance yourself from the current Israeli government just in what you've already told us. But I wonder whether you do agree with the statement that Benjamin Netanyahu made in writing to the Australian Prime Minister, accusing the Labour government of pouring fuel on the anti-Semitic fire. And he went on to say, anti-Semitism is a cancer. It spreads when leaders stay silent. I mean, are you saying that actually the Australian government has done more than stay silent?
Well, I think what Netanyahu was referring to was a more of a political issue concerning the Australian recognition of the Palestinian statehood, which I'm not sure, and this is a completely different issue, I'm not sure that the two can be conflated on the political level. However, he does have a point in saying that perhaps not enough was being done to work against anti-Semitism in Australia and elsewhere. I mean, let's face it, incidents have been happening, as I said earlier, on an almost incessant basis, weekly or monthly basis in Australia. And it's not enough just to condemn it by saying this is not Australian, or this is not our way of life, or this is not the way we should be acting. Of course it's not the way you should be acting. And I don't for a moment believe that Albanese or anyone around him hasn't even an anti-Semitic bone or anti-Semitic hair on his head. Not at all. I don't believe that. However, they need to ask themselves, have they done enough?
Yeah,
and it's such, the answer is speaks for itself.
Absolutely, and it is such a good question to ask Mark Sofer about what it is that governments need to do when they say this isn't us, we aren't these type of people. You know, you're preaching to the choir, aren't you? All of your decent and good citizens will go, no, we're not that type of person. This is terrible. But those aren't the people that you need to reach, are they?
I think you couldn't have hit the nail on the head more than you actually just did so. Of course it's not Australian to carry out what happened yesterday. Of course it's not British to carry out what happened in Manchester a few months back, etc., etc. Of course not. But these are not the people who adhere to the values and the civilized approach that is the UK or that is Australia, etc. We should be talking here, or they should be talking here, to the extremists, to the half-crazed or the crazed lunatics that are carrying this out. And they can't be spoken to in simple terms of civilization, of values, etc. They're killers. They're murderers. They think nothing of massacre and slaughter. So more has to be done to clamp down against the environment that is conducive to getting them out of their hole carry out this type of attack. More has to be done on the intelligence side. More has to be done on the policing side. And more has to be done in calming down those demonstrations in which anti-Semitic slogans are called in day in and day out. And in fact, now that we have a ceasefire, it's almost difficult to see why there are these demonstrations going on. But they have a right to demonstrate, and nobody's arguing against that. It is what's going on in them that is crucially dangerous.
And do you know much about any enhanced intelligence gathering that might have started to happen in Australia? Do you believe that Australia is kind of in the intelligence loop enough?
Well, obviously not enough, because that was palpable from what we saw. But I wouldn't say that they're not in the intelligence loop at all. Reports here in the press, and I stress that they are press reports, not something that I know about on any personal or professional basis, say that they did get, you know, have been getting information about working up of extremists in Australia. And we know that Australia itself kicked out the Iranian ambassador just a few months ago for fomenting violence against the Jewish community. I don't know whether Iran was involved in this one, but it's not unlikely, but nonetheless, they have intelligence, they have the wherewithal, but the question is, are they using it to the full? And I think they have to do some sort of self-examination here, like all countries which are suffering the scourge of anti-Semitic terror.
What does Albanese need to do now, just over the coming days? What would you like to hear him say and see him do?
That's a difficult question, and one which would be tough to answer without being condescending or patronising. But I think you heard earlier that he's a close friend of mine, one of the leaders of the Jewish community in Australia, Alex Rifkin. And I've spoken on a number of occasions over the last day and a half to many of the leaders of the Jewish community in Australia. The fear is palpable. They feel really under attack. 120,000, 130,000 Jews living in Australia contributed so much to Australian society, and they are fearful that the next of leaving their homes, of going to the synagogue, without being attacked by one of these maniacs of the types we saw, the father and son in Sydney yesterday. And so, yes, they need reassurance, but they need reassurance not just in words; they need reassurance in action. There has to be more of a police presence, I would suppose, which is not an Australian thing because it's been so open, but nonetheless, it's palpably necessary now, outside Jewish community centres, Jewish synagogues, etc. There needs to be more intelligence, perhaps more liaison, I don't know, with the community and with the community security apparatuses. But clearly something more has to be done than just, we are with you at this time. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much indeed for your time this afternoon. We appreciate your thoughts. That's Mark Sofer, who was the Israeli ambassador to Australia from 2017 until 2020.
Well, coming up, we'll look back on the life of the director, Rob Reiner. It's just gone 3:15. This is Fee Glover and Warrenika on Times Radio with Wix, the expert in kitchens and bathrooms.
John Pienaar on Times Radio, telling the stories that matter.
You consider those attacks are justified. They're controversial, but you back those attacks.
Expert analysis and well-informed discussion.
Taking you inside America. I'm going to be talking to local reporters, journalists, dealing with the changes taking place across America.
And diverse opinion.
Personally, I find it hard to even say that out loud without laughing.
John Pienaar, a drive. Tomorrow afternoon from 4 on Times Radio.
In areas overwhelmed by conflicts and natural disasters, we can't miss a life-saving moment. As a doctor with Médecins Sans Frontières, I've seen how a moment lost can mean a life lost. Right now, MSF is working across the globe, providing maternity care, containing outbreaks, performing vital surgeries. We can't miss a life-saving moment. MSF needs help. Your help. Every attack, disease, and natural disaster puts more people at risk and calls for our teams to go further and faster. Medical emergencies move quickly, so must we. £50 will keep our work going and make a life or death difference. The life-saving moment is now. To give £50, call 0800 055 7979. That's 0800 055 7979. Or search MSF Urgent. Thank you.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix. Looking for inspiration for your new kitchen? Let Wix help you find brilliant kitchen ideas. Browse the Wix Kitchen Gallery or try the Matchmaker tool to find a style that suits you. Find the gallery and matchmaker at wix.co.uk.
I'd like to briefly return to a topic that we were considering in the last hour of the programme when Roya did a fabulous interview with Lord Sewell, Tony Sewell, about the arrival on the UK scene, really, of Nick Fuentes, who is a US hard right, far right campaigner, says some really extraordinary things about the Nazis, about Hitler, about all kinds of stuff. And we were talking about him because he is going to be in conversation with Piers Morgan on Uncensored. Gary Fleming says this: poor Fee Glover, an expert with a contrary opinion on the woke racism that all white males have an advantage that won't back down. It's obvious to a blind man that if you continue to tell white boys they're racist and have an advantage in life that doesn't actually exist and no one can see, they will eventually become radicalised. There's no need to feel sorry for me here at all, Gary. I can absolutely take on board that people have different opinions. But I would challenge you about that, though. I'm not sure that we should assume that any community that doesn't see an advantage, have an advantage and live an advantage must become radicalised. That's relevant to our previous conversation and the dreadful things that have happened over in Australia over the weekend. And also, it is just a fact that many, many of these young men who are following Andrew Tate and Nick Fuentes, they are not from an underprivileged place. They are making a choice to follow men who are advocating a really extraordinary path in life. I find it extraordinary anyway. You're very, very free to tell me that you don't. Ignite your wanderlust at Destinations, the holiday and travel show 2026, the ultimate event for travel inspiration, coming to Manchester Central and Olympia, London this January. It's the perfect place to plan your next bucket list adventure. You'll find more than 700 top travel brands and over 120 tourist boards across both shows, all sharing expert advice on the world's most exciting destinations. You can enjoy live talks from the Times editorial team, plus incredible guests like Sir Michael Palin, Anita Rani, Race Across the World's Brian and Melvin. That'd be worth the admission fee alone. Travel journalist Simon Calder and many, many more. Because you're a listener, you can claim up to 2 complimentary tickets and you only pay the £1.75 booking fee. Book now at destinationsshows.com and use the code TIMES2026.
The legendary Hollywood director and actor Rob Reiner and his wife Michelle have been found dead in an apparent homicide. Authorities are said to be questioning a family member after the police were called to his Los Angeles home on Sunday afternoon. The list of films made by Rob Reiner is extraordinary, and the chances are one of your favourites was made by him.
I'm not taking him. Nobody's taking him.
Come on, kid. Just give me the gun before you take your foot off. You ain't got the sack to shoot a woodchuck.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
Stonehenge, where the demons dwell, where the banshees live and they dwell. Stonehenge.
What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
He didn't fall? Inconceivable.
You keep using the word. I don't think it means what you think it means.
I came here tonight because when you realize you want to spend the rest of your life with somebody, you want the rest of your life to start as soon as possible.
You see? That is just like you, Harry. You say things like that and you make it impossible for me to hate you. And I hate you, Harry. I really hate you.
Well, a few jewels in Rob Reiner's crown there. Stand By Me, A Few Good Men, Spinal Tap, my favourite, The Princess Bride, and Fees When Harry Met Sally. Well, the Sunday Times columnist Hadley Freeman is working on a tribute to Reiner for the Times, and I'm delighted to say that Hadley joins us now. Hadley, welcome to the show. Thank you. You actually met Rob Reiner. Tell us a little bit about what he was like.
Yes, I met Rob a bunch of times and actually just spoke with him a few months ago for something else I'm working on. He really was just, I mean, I just can't believe it. He really just was the sweetest, most generous, humble guy. And he by no means should have been, as well as being a hugely successful Hollywood director, producer, and also actor in many things. He was, you know, a child of a very successful actor and director, Carl Reiner, who I also know. So by rights, he should have been just an obnoxious Hollywood brat. And yet he was exactly the opposite. You know, any time I told him, and I told him every time, you know, no one's had a run of movies like he did. All those ones you just named, Roya, plus Misery, I put in there. Mm. You know, no one could compare with that amazing run. And he would just always say, oh, you know, I was just lucky, or, you know, the actors are so incredible, and, you know, the screenwriters, oh my God. And never mention that he did a lot of the screenwriting and rewriting. There was really no one sweeter or humbler than Rob Reiner in Hollywood, I think.
And what impact do you think his body of work has had on not only the film industry, but writers, directors who were influenced by him, do you think?
I mean, you know, just from the first, Spinal Tap has influenced pretty much every satire that comes after. It established the mockumentary format that we've seen, you know, from The Office onwards. The Princess Bride was really the first that is a children's movie that can be enjoyed equally by adults. You know, Shrek was so hugely influenced by The Princess Bride. When Harry Met Sally totally rejuvenated the rom-com genre. Also, you know, huge impact on Nora Ephron and her career. You know, you just go on and on. You look at his movies. Also, he was the first one to make a really good Stephen King movie with Stand By Me. That was a Stephen King story. And because Rob did such a good job with it, then Stephen King trusted him with King's most treasured book, which was Misery. And his production company, Castle Rock, that's named after the town in Stephen King's books, like, they were very close. And, you know, that then led to all these movies that came out afterwards, Shawshank Redemption, all these other Stephen King movies. You know, there's just so much influence. And on top of that, he was a huge political influence, which doesn't get talked about very much. He really was behind, you know, same-sex marriage being allowed in California, the ban being overturned, higher taxes on cigarettes and alcohol, and that money then being funneled into prenatal care. Like, it's just so many great things that he was just a pure good guy.
The tributes to him have been absolutely overwhelmingly making that point that both he and his father, Carl, were, you know,
the rare gem in Hollywood of being lovely, kind, generous-hearted people. There has been recently one detractor, and that is President Trump, who has very recently said this of Reiner. He was a once very talented movie director and comedy star who has passed away, according to Trump, in his words, reportedly due to the anger he caused others through his massive, unyielding and incurable affliction with a mind-crippling disease known as TDS or Trump Derangement Syndrome. Hadley, what do you make of those comments?
You know, Rob Reiner brought more happiness to more people in one day than Trump will ever do in his entire lifetime. Mm-hmm. Also, name me one policy that Trump has done that compares with any of the policies that Rob pushed through in California, despite not being a politician. Trump is a massive narcissist. We all know this. I'm not surprised he would try to take the spotlight from Rob's tributes, but I'm not going to give him mine.
Good. You spoke to him quite recently. There's a lovely picture on your Instagram about you photographing, trying to take a picture of his princess bride poster on his wall, which I have to say I commend you for. How was he when you spoke to him? What was he up to? What was he working on?
He was heaven. And it, you know what? This is like so typical Rob. He wasn't working on anything. I was working on something. I'm currently writing a book and it's about someone that he knew. And so I emailed him to ask if I could get some quotes from him for the book. You know, I know you're so busy, Rob. I'm really sorry. Wrote back right away, set up a Zoom, you know, chatted for 2 hours. Just, you know, he got no benefit to him for this. This is all benefit to me. And when you go to Rob Reiner's office, or when you would go, you know, he's got all these film posters of his works behind him on the wall and memorabilia. And there was the Man in Black sword hanging right over his shoulder. So I asked if I could try and take a photo of that. As well as, you know, the posters, An American President, A Few Good Men, Misery, et cetera, et cetera. You cannot believe how successful this guy was. And yet he was willing to Zoom with me 4 p.m. on a Tuesday for some, you know, book that I'm writing. Like, you know, he was just the best. He really was.
And what was your favorite film of his, Hadley, I have to ask?
Well, yeah, for me, it's going to have to be When Harry Met Sally. I agree with Fia about that. But, you know, The Princess Bride, I can literally recite from beginning.
Yes, me so, too.
So, they, you know, those movies are just imprinted on our hearts. Yeah. You know, same with the courtroom scenes in A Few Good Men, same with the hammering scene in Misery. This is all Rob. It's amazing. Mm.
Well, I think most of us will agree to disagree with what Trump has said.
Oh, we're so, so going to disagree with that. I've read that statement through a couple of times, and it just, I mean, it just beggars belief.
Bonkers.
That when somebody dies, A, your first thought is about yourself, and B, you write that. I mean, it's just, it's beyond horrible, actually, isn't it?
Yes.
But I'm absolutely with you, Hadley, just on the scenes that Rob Reiner has left imprinted in our minds. And everybody laughs about When Harry Met Sally, don't they, and think that you're referring to the cafe scene, which of course is memorable. But it's shots like the one that's on the poster, which is Harry and Sally lying in bed together, you know, but, you know, fully clothed and whatever. It's just clever. He just had that ability as a director to see in the reality in front of him something that was cinematic and needed recording forever. So he was nothing short of a genius, and we don't need to have any kind of disagreement about which of his films was best, because there are just too many, and I'll happily concede defeat to you.
That will never happen again.
And
well,
to you, Hadley.
Well, that's Hadley, and you will soon be able to read her tribute to Rob Reiner with your Time subscription.
Coming up, we're going to open the doors of our literary salon, and we're going to help you with any questions you have about the new rules surrounding ISAs. It's just gone 3:30. Let's get a check first on the latest news headlines with Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Health Secretary Wes Streeting says resident doctors in England can still put off a five-day strike until January. Members of the British Medical Association have voted to walk out as planned from this Wednesday after rejecting a new offer from the government. Keir Starmer says yesterday's attack on Bondi Beach was not an isolated incident but part of a pattern focused on Jewish holy days.
It was an appalling anti-Semitic terror attack that took place yesterday, and I'm sure I speak for the whole committee and the whole House, in fact the whole country, in saying our thoughts are with those affected by this attack.
The Prime Minister's facing questions from MPs on the liaison committee this afternoon. He says he wants to reassure Jewish communities in the UK that every step will be taken to ensure their safety. Australia is expected to strengthen gun laws after the terror attack, which killed 15 people. Ukraine's top negotiator has described talks with the US team in Berlin to end Russia's invasion as constructive and productive. In a post on social media, Rustem Umerov said real progress has been achieved, adding he hopes to reach an agreement that'll bring us closer to peace by the end of the day. Kyiv handed an updated peace plan to Washington last week. A court has heard a former Royal Marine lost his temper when he drove into more than 100 people at Liverpool's Premier League victory parade in May. Prosecutors have told Paul Doyle's sentencing hearing he used his car as a weapon to get where he wanted. And an amber rain warning for possible danger to life has come into force in parts of southern Wales. Up to 88 millimetres is predicted in some areas. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
This is Times Radio.
The Big Tasty is back at McDonald's, but now it's a double. It's the beefiest Big Tasty of all time ever. Oh, got a bit intense there. The new Double Big Tasty, now at McDonald's. Available until the 4th of Jan 2026 from 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary, subject to availability.
What good is sitting?
Winning a record-breaking 7 Olivier Awards, Cabaret at the Kit Kat Club is still the best musical in London, says the Daily Telegraph.
Life is a cabaret, chum.
The most electrifying night out starts the minute you step inside. Outside it is winter, but in here it is so hot. So right this way, your stage side table is waiting. Book your tickets for a perfectly marvellous gift this Christmas at KitKat.club.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles at Wickes. There's a kitchen to suit every home, with prices starting from under £3,000. Start planning your new kitchen. Book a free design appointment at wickes.co.uk.
So Derek in Buckinghamshire says, how can you mention Rob Reiner and not The Wolf of Wall Street? Happy to mention it now. It's not really in our top three Rob Reiner favourites, though, is it?
No, it hasn't snuck in, I'm afraid.
No, and it's one of those movies, Derek, I think I tried to watch that once with a teenager belonging to me, and very soon you realise that you shouldn't. You need to go and watch it in separate rooms. The author of The Salt Path, Raina Wynne, has denied taking money from her family and called the new accusations against her a false narrative. This comes ahead of a new documentary on the literary scandal, which is going to air tonight on Sky. It's one of many things we're going to talk about with Alex Clark, literary journalist and host of the TLS podcast. We haven't had access to the documentary as yet, Alex, but these latest accusations really paint Raina Wynne and her husband in an even poorer light. And I wonder what that does now to the books, which are on sale. And I mean, ironically, if that's the right word to use, the sales went up when all of this new stuff first surfaced. So what do you make of it?
Well, it's very difficult to talk about truth in memoir, isn't it? Because we know that even our own memories are subject to all sorts of influences, and they change over time. Now, that is in a different order than deliberate and outright falsification. But I mean, when it actually all first started, I wrote about it in a sort of wider context of the kind of books that people write that are in some way designed to be inspirational, what they are partly selling, what they are certainly marketed as, whatever the author's intention, is a way for, in this case, the natural world to provide you with a way to turn your life around, to provide a kind of solace. And I think people who write very close up to the natural world are pretty clear that what we should not be looking to that environment for is answers to our own personal problems. That what we should be understanding is that nature and the animal kingdom and the plant kingdom and our environment exist in their own right. So to make it a sort of way for you to immerse yourself in something that will take you out of the problems of your daily life is a mistake, which is a slightly sideways answer to your question.
No, but I very much enjoyed it, Alex, as I always enjoy chatting with you. What do you think it will have changed about the commissioning and the editing process with exactly those type of books, though?
I mean, I think, look, it would be kind of nigh on impossible for any commissioning editor or critic to investigate the whole circumstances of anybody who's written a piece of life writing, as we would call it, a piece of autobiography or memoir. This is before we even get into the whole territory of autofiction, of novels that are that draw heavily on the real life of their authors. You couldn't expect it. Now, clearly, all publishers will take seriously claims of defamation. They will not want to publish something where there has been, a clear evidence of a crime, or the suggestion that a crime has been committed. But I don't think you can really go back to something like this and say, well, they should have known. I do, on the other hand, think that when there are stories that appear to offer this kind of transformative arc, then it may well be the case that editors and publishers are looking more closely at those and saying, you know, perhaps we should be more sceptical.
Yeah, and in a way, I mean, that's the ultimate sadness of all of this, isn't it? That if you read the book and you're uplifted by it and you believe the narrative arc, it gave you a sense of unicorns and rainbows in your life. And then all of this has just taken you down, hasn't it?
Yeah, I guess that's true. Now, I would say that if you felt uplifted, then, you know, obviously you can't go back and not know about this story, but you are still uplifted by that experience of reading. You know, the words on those pages are still true to your reading experience. Lots of the claims made in them are very likely still true.
Yeah. And we can also just choose to move it to the fiction side of our brains, can't we? And still have enjoyed it for that.
Yeah, particularly if you have a nice porous boundary between those two sides of your brain, as I always like to do.
Nice way of putting it. shall we talk about the very sad news about Sophie Kinsella's death? And Joanna Trollope died last week too. If you were looking to explore either of those remarkable writers, where would you suggest somebody begins if they have never read either of them?
Well, I guess, you know, you would go in with Sophie Kinsella, you would go into those tales centred around the character of Becky Bloomwood, a financial journalist, as Sophie Kinsella herself had been, who is, shall we say, in hock to the lure of the credit card and keen on a shopping spree. The Shopaholic books, of which there were many but three at the beginning of the career, and starting with The Secret Dream World of a Shopaholic, they kind of captured, they were published at the turn of the century, and they captured that intense kind of desire to buy a new life, essentially. And I think they were probably far more satiric about that than they were given credit for when they were just bracketed in, you know, the pink cover Shopaholic sort of idea. You know, the Shopaholic was taken, but nothing else was. With Joanna Trollope, I would say go to those contemporary novels that really made her name. She wrote a lot of historical romances before she started to publish books about current day life. So I would go to The Rector's Wife, The Choir, A Village Affair, those books that really, really brought her to public attention. What I do think is amazing about both of these writers is that they worked so hard. You know, they reoriented when things weren't working, as in Trollope's case. You know, she moved away from the historical romance, even though, you know, as she published those under the name of Caroline Harvey, they had done well for her. Sophie Kinsella just kept on writing. She herself had written novels under her real name, Madeline Wickham. But then they just kept going and they kept looking for the thing that they would really connect with readers. And they both did it. They were incredibly prolific and incredibly hardworking.
And when that happens, when a very well-known author writes under a different pen name, is everybody in the kind of marketing and bookselling side of the business told on the quiet that this is from the original pen of an established author? Because otherwise, you know, somebody called Catherine Harvey, how would anybody know that that was a book worth pushing?
Well, in that case, I mean, I don't know what happened in the publishing house, but I would imagine it was a clear sort of pivot. I mean, look, it wasn't the case with J.K. Rowling and Robert Galbraith. I must say, I think that was a very closely guarded secret, and that was a very extreme pivot from Harry Potter to the world of Cormoran Strike and detective novels. But, you know, I never quite understand when, you know, you get a name on the front of a cover and it says so-and-so writing as. That seems to me to be having your cake both ways. But somewhere where it did, you know, make a lot of sense was in Ruth Rendell, who wrote as Barbara Vine, and they were a kind of distinction. You know, she wrote Wexford novels under one name and she wrote psychological thrillers under another. They always become a bit blurry, I think. But it, you know, it's a way for people to keep it straight in their minds, I suppose.
Yeah, we're back to the porous divides in our brains, I think, aren't we?
It's getting more porous the closer we get to Christmas.
It certainly is. Happens every year. What would you recommend in terms of a bit of personal reading at the moment?
Well, look, I have to say, I'm really trying to keep my head straight by going between kind of one thing and the next. So I am listening to a very old book by Josephine Tay, who's a wonderful detective writer. I'm listening to A Shilling for Candles, which is a kind of a murder mystery set in the world of the London theatre. It's absolutely great. I am reading a very different book, Drive Your Plough Over the Bones of the Dead by the Polish Nobel Prize winner Olga Tokarczuk, which, should it sound a bit forbidding, that title is a quote from William Blake, with whom the narrator is semi-obsessed, but she's actually more obsessed with horoscopes. It's actually incredibly funny, and so I heavily recommend that. And if you haven't read a book by The Wedding People by Alison Espach, I firmly recommend it as your piece of escapist reading.
Okay, and is that a contemporary novel?
That is a contemporary novel, and she is a great writer. It's about a woman who goes to a wedding who goes to a hotel to escape a very dark place in her life, only to discover that she is the only person at the hotel who is not part of the wedding party.
Right. Stuff of nightmares.
And the bride is not very pleased about it.
Okay. Those sound like terrific recommendations. If somebody is listening who is searching for the perfect Christmas present for you, Alex Clark, what would that be?
Well, I've actually put in my request. Who knows whether it will arrive? But I want a thumping great tome, a great volume of Seamus Heaney's poetry, which has recently been released, and I hope that I'm going to be opening that, you know, not least because that's going to look quite classy around the Christmas tree, isn't it?
That will look so classy around the Christmas
tree. Don't you think? Yeah. And I can just retreat to a quiet and say, I'm reading poetry, leave me alone, everyone.
Okay, well, I hope all of your friends are listening. Alex would like the very big thumping collection of Seamus Heaney's poems. Not in a stocking, it's too big for a stocking. Just under the
wheelbarrow.
Do. Yeah. It's always lovely to talk to you, Alex. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
indeed.
And you. Bye.
So I know that lots of people are driving or just doing something whenever we're talking about books and it becomes annoying. So I'm just going to say quite slowly, in case you can get to a place where you've got a pen or something, the books that we have mentioned there, The Wedding People by Alison Espach and Drive Your Plough Over the Bones of the Dead by Olga Tokarczuk. I hope I've pronounced those correctly. It is almost 4:15. I tell you what, I'm going to say some more words, if that's all right. After a big shake-up in the budget, what do you need to know about ISIS? Our money man, Adam Shaw, has got the answer to that. You're listening to Fee Glover and Roy Anika on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6 with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Water. It doesn't get nearly enough credit. You drink it, you grow your dinner with it, you wash your bits with it.
You surf on it like some kind of levitating wizard. Yes, water is the greatest. Without it, Earth would be just another dry, crusty cosmic fail, like Mars. Think about it. Everything you know and love starts with water. Your dog, your car, your internet, which is basically just a load of sweaty computers kept cool in a bath. And then there is just a small miracle of keeping us alive. Without drinking water, you wouldn't survive more than 3 days. Some mates take longer to text you back. So let's raise a glass to clean water. It's hard to imagine life without it. Seriously, how is it that a million people die every year because they lack access to clean water? That's not just unthinkable. That's wrong. Donate to WaterAid today. Just £2 a month can give life-changing clean water.
Christmas on Times Radio.
That is it. Christmas on Times Radio. You're all very welcome to gather around the tree. It's warm, it's lovely, it's festive. The news never stops, and we'll be carrying you through the festive season, I think, on the back of a metaphorical sleigh. Every Monday to Thursday, you can hear the 3:30 interview again, just in case you missed it. And you can hear that on the Off Air with Jane and Fee podcast, which, even though Jane is away at the moment, it still continues. It's the Off Air with Fee /E/Hannah/Jane Mulcairns/anybody else who's in the building podcast. But the 3:30 interviews remain the same. Recently, we've had some really cracking guests, Chris Van Tulligan, Spencer Matthews and Sally Wainwright. And last week, we spoke to Paul Feig, director of films like Bridesmaids, Ghostbusters and Spy. I asked Paul how he thinks filmmakers will look back at this period in time.
Transitionary, I would dare say. But again, you know, theaters kind of got in trouble during COVID, and it's taken a while to come back, but it's coming back. I mean, if you look at the box office reports recently, things are, you know, people are coming back to theaters, but they're more discerning because it's really expensive to go to the movies. And I do think the studios should probably figure out a way to drop the prices a bit because, you know, I was just talking to when we did a premiere in New York, and one of the workers at the theater was saying, yeah, I took my kids to see Zootopia 2 and it was like $100 for, you know, and that's the problem, you know, so that's one of the problems. On top of just making sure that we're putting stuff in the theaters where you go like, okay, it's worth it to get out of my house and pack up the car and go and pay money.
That is the director, Paul Feig, and he was in to talk about The Housemaid, which is a box office guarantee. I think it opens on Boxing Day in the UK. It's an adaptation of the hugely successful Freda McFadden novel of the same name.
Now, the Chancellor's budget has triggered the biggest shake-up of ISAs in more than a decade, and it's already changing how millions of people save. Well, our resident money man, Adam Shaw, is here to make sense of it all and guide us through what all the changes mean and how to buy and sell shares in an ISA for free. Adam, welcome. What is the first big change that's happened? What's actually shifted here with ISAs?
Well, what the Chancellor announced is that anyone under 65 is going to see their annual cash allowance, ISA allowance, cut from its current level, which is £20,000. That's what you can put in your ISA, to just £12,000. The full old limit remains for those aged 65 and over. So what happens now is that if you're under 65, you're going to be pushed into invest in what are inherently riskier stock market related assets rather than safer deposit like accounts like a bank account. So that's the big, big change. You're being pushed towards shares. There's also, in the small print, a complication. And it's so upsetting that because so much of finance is overly complex and ridiculous. And ISAs were nice and simple. They were sort of just did what they said they were going to do. Well, now they're introducing some complexity as well. So if you invest in an ISA in something called cash-like investments, no one entirely sure what that means exactly, but then you'll be taxed on that. So what's going to happen is they're going to become a bit more complex and you're going to have to move towards shares if you want to use your full ISA allowance.
And why has Rachel Reeves, why is she pushing everyone more towards investing in stocks and shares rather than cash ISAs?
Now you're asking me to look into the minds of politicians, which is a whole other area here, I'm afraid. I think the best that can be said about this is that she wants to get British money, UK money, supporting the UK stock market, and this will do that. It's a little more complex than that, because if you look at actually the FTSE 100, much of the value in the FTSE 100 are companies which may be listed in the London stock market, but are actually not particularly British companies. We have a very international market. So even in that perhaps laudable aim, who knows, it's a little more complex than it first sounds.
So the changes take place from next year, Adam, but is there a way round the new restrictions on how much you can save if you get a bit of forward planning in there?
Yeah, absolutely. So as with a number of things on the budget, in fact, when we were talking about the budget, I think Fee asked, well, when does this affect all these announcements take effect? And they come into different times. So although we know what's going to happen with the ISA, the changes only come into effect from April 2027. So you can still make use of the upper allowance if you put your money into ISAs now. And of course, although I'm talking about shares, you still have cash ISAs there. So just to give you a point of comparison, the current Bank of England base rate is 4%. The Bank of England's meant to keep inflation at 2%. It's failing to do that. But it says, the bank says, it thinks inflation will fall, and as a result, they think they will be able to reduce interest rates. Why is that important? Well, this is why. Because if it is true, and it is a big if, then it might be worth considering locking in some savings at some rather good rates now. So these are cash ISAs, and there are a few of them out there. Aldermore has a two-year fixed rate at 4.01%. HTB, Hampshire Trust Bank, has a similar one at 4%. NatWest has a two-year fixed at 4%. Royal Bank of Scotland has a fixed rate ISA at 4%. You, just as with the book recommendations Fee was talking about, you probably haven't written those down. So I would suggest you go to a great comparison site called moneyfactscompare.co.uk, and you can have a look at the best fixed rates there.
Adam, we've just had a message in from a listener, Dan, who says, what about for existing ISAs? Is there any change? If you're investing in your ISAs now, do these new changes, are you completely protected by these
new
changes?
So if you've got money already in the ISA, so if you've funded your fully £20,000 this year, there won't be any change, or indeed from 2027, what you've already done in the past is safe, which is why I think it's rather important to act now, because you can beat these new regulations by acting now. Post the new tax year in 2027, new money, new ISAs will be affected. So stuff you do now will be fine.
Is it in people's interests, Adam, to be pushed into the stock market in the way the government's trying to do? I mean, will it be long-term beneficial? Obviously, it depends on how the market goes. But
It does depend how the market goes. And one of the problems with the stock market, it's unpredictable. However, if you look over the long term, on almost every period that you look at, the stock market outperforms what you could put into a bank account. Now, there are two things to say here. One is, when I talk about the stock market, I'm just talking, for instance, of the FTSE 100 index. So you could invest in a tracker which tracks that. You can invest in lots of different versions of that, but let's, for simplicity, look at that. And there's lots of research which shows, over the long term, that's a really good thing to do. Schroders, a big investment group, did a big study looking at past performance going all the way back to 1926. And in fact, comparing that with cash, it found there's a 40% increase between what you would have made in cash and shares over a 20-year period. NatWest, she's done, I can't show it to you because it's a graph, but I've put it on the article I've written in support of this piece, a lovely graph which just shows you what the stock market has done since 2003. And it's super volatile. So you get a US-China trade war, you get coronavirus outbreaks, you get the Truss budget, then you have huge collapses. But even given that, over the long term, I'm talking 4, 5, 10 years, it massively has outperformed cash in the past. There's no guarantee that will happen in the future, but it would be remarkable if over the long term that pattern doesn't continue to exist. And that's why shares are appealing.
We've had another question in from Colin, who says, what protection do you get with the new ISA? I had shares in two companies. When they change ownership, I have half of my investments in both companies.
I mean, an ISA isn't an investment. You think of it like a chocolate bar. You don't buy a Mars or a Twix because of the wrapper. You buy it because you like what's inside it. And an ISA is a wrapper which protects what's inside it from tax. Now, if you've put rubbish shares in it or shares which turn out to be rubbish, there's nothing that can be done with the ISA wrapper. It's going to protect you from being taxed on the profit. Well, if you haven't made a profit, well, then there's no tax to pay anyway. So that's what I'm saying. There are risks involved in all of this, but the ISA protection will stop you getting taxed on any profits.
And just finally, Adam, if people want to invest in shares, are you usually trading fees? But you've got a couple of tips of how to get around that and doing it for free, don't you?
Yes. I mean, I really think people should be looking at this, not just for your ISAs, but for any share trading. There's two companies I know of. Do get in touch with me if you know more. But Trading 212 and Free Trade both offer fairly straightforward free trading accounts. I've tried both of them. They're both similar. I have to say, I got completely confused by the software that Trading 212 run, and their help desk, I think, wasn't actually telling me the correct stuff. I much preferred Free Trade. It was a much more intuitive way of working out. And there are no commission fees on trading. So if you're buying an ISA, a tracker, that might be something worth looking at. And indeed, if you're an active share trader, that also might be worth looking at. There are costs involved if it gets a bit more complex, but a straightforward trade are free on those platforms. And hopefully that's a lesson to the incumbents to actually, they should up their game and start offering these sorts of services. But at the moment, it's very limited. But yeah, you can trade for free on Trading 212 and Free Trade.
Well, that is the lowdown on all the ISA changes from Adam Shaw.
And you can follow Adam at Adam Shaw Biz, B-I-Z, on the Twitter, and that's where his fabulous graph can be found. That's it from Roya, and that's it from me for today. We are back together tomorrow, 2 till 4. Our producer today was Rosie Cutler. Our technical operator was Ryan Boyden. Just to let you know, we've got fabulous guests this week. The comic and Strictly champ, Chris McCausland, is in. Tomorrow, it will be Susie Wolfe, head of F1 Academy. She's got a memoir out about her time being the only woman to have driven Formula One. And Andrew Billen is going to join us this week too. It is an interview with the interviewer. Up next, it's John Pina with Drive. Enjoy your evening when you get to it.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Roya. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar. This is Times Radio Drive. And here are the headlines. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, says resident doctors can still put off a five-day strike after the British Medical Association voted to walk out from Wednesday. And Ukraine's top negotiator has described talks with the US team in Berlin to end Russia's invasion as constructive and productive. And coming up, I'll be talking live to the BMA and to the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, as well as to another union that says the striking doctors are putting the BMA's interests ahead of patient care. And we're going to be expecting a White House news conference later on those Ukraine talks. We'll keep you up to date with that. And we are on the front line of the war in Russia. We are with Russia. It's the view of the head of the MI6 and the chief of the British Armed Forces. And I'm going to be talking to a top NATO general and to the Times defence editor to find out more.
This is Times Radio.
And now the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. A strike by resident doctors in the run-up to Christmas is set to go ahead after union members voted to reject a last-minute offer. British Medical Association members will walk out for 5 days from Wednesday, with 83% of them voting against a deal. But the government says it'll damage the health service just as superflu sweeps the nation. Matthew Taylor of the NHS Confederation says it's devastating.
If senior members of staff, consultant colleagues have to go down to, for example, the emergency department or general medical ward because resident doctors aren't there, that means they're not undertaking operations or they're not undertaking outpatient appointments. That adds to the waiting list.
The Pope has called for an end to anti-Semitic violence after Sunday's attack on Jewish people at Bondi Beach in Sydney. Two gunmen, a father and son, killed 15 people and injured at least 40 others. Australia's Prime Minister believes the attackers were motivated by extremism. He's considering tougher gun laws. Rabbi Benjamin Elton was friends with British-born Eli Schlanger, one of the victims.
Above all, he was a husband and a father. He was a man who cared for everybody. There's a general sense of shock, grief, horror, and we all have to look after each other at this very, very difficult and tragic time.
The son of Rob Reiner has been arrested after the director and his wife were found dead at their home in Los Angeles. The Sheriff's Department says the 32-year-old is in custody. The 78-year-old filmmaker's works included When Harry Met Sally and Stand By Me. The new head of MI6 is warning that the front line is everywhere, with Moscow's use of hybrid warfare such as disinformation, sabotage and cyber attacks. Blaise Metrovelli is the first female boss of MI6. In her first public speech, she'll say Putin will continue his export of chaos until he's forced into a rethink. Christopher Steele ran the Russia desk of MI6 between 2006 and 2009. He told Times Radio why the threat from Russia needs to be taken so seriously.
Now the US is making overtures to Russia and effectively cultivating some sort of reset of its relationship with Putin's regime. That Britain stands out now, I think, as the most solid opponent of Russia and Russia's agenda, and particularly in regard for support to Ukraine. So the Britain, whether we like it or not, the UK will become a major priority target for Russia over the coming years.
The former head of the British Army, Lord Dannert, told Times Radio, "We'll be in an interesting position if NATO membership for Ukraine is on the table and then taken off it." Volodymyr Zelensky has indicated that Kyiv is prepared to drop its long-held ambition in exchange for Western security guarantees. He's expected to meet Keir Starmer and other European leaders in Berlin this evening. In response, the Kremlin said this was a fundamental question in the broader peace process. Lord Dannert says it poses an intriguing question.
If there is not going to be NATO membership for Ukraine and just a series of bilateral arrangements, well, we're kind of in a position we were in 1939, 1940, where we had given a security guarantee to Poland. Germany attacked Poland. We declared war on Germany, didn't do much about it, and the Germans captured Poland. So we are in an interesting situation if NATO membership is on the table and taken off it as far as the Ukraine is concerned.
It's emerged the Nobel Peace Prize winner fractured her back as she fled Venezuela on a small boat. Opposition leader Maria Corina Machado travelled to Oslo to receive the prize, but arrived too late for the ceremony last week. She travelled despite a decade-long travel ban. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. The Doctors' Union, the BMA, deciding to strike over Christmas was widely predicted, not least by the BMA leadership. It has lit the blue touch paper for an explosive reaction, and I'm guessing you'll hear the bang when the Health Secretary joins me live later on in the programme. The level of anger among members of the public who believe it's time for the strike to end, that will be equally unsurprising. But the depth of that anger and the way a Christmas strike turns opinion against the BMA, that may, just may, be striking. And we're going to see now whether the Health Secretary's warnings of the doctors straining and breaking the bonds of trust and affection between NHS doctors and the public come true. It is a sad and maybe all too predictable outcome. But what are your thoughts? Tell me a text, 87222. Start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. And also today, we'd intended naturally to bring you the latest on the awful killing of the much-loved movie director Rob Reiner, who was found dead with his wife Michelle at their home in Los Angeles. His son has been arrested. But just before we came on air, President Trump took to social media and blamed the killing on what he called Rob Reiner's mind-crippling disease known as Trump Derangement Syndrome. And the anger that Trump said he'd caused others through his, as he said, raging obsession with Donald J. Trump. It was a, frankly, astonishing intervention, and we're going to be reporting on that too. And a little later, the heads of the British Armed Forces and of MI6 are warning the country to brace itself and prepare to face the threat from Vladimir Putin's Russia, which sounds like good advice. What does it mean? What should we do? What should we sacrifice? More on that coming up. First, though, It's official then. From Wednesday, resident doctors in England are going to be going on strike for 5 days during the height of a flu season after, of course, soundly rejecting the government's latest offer. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, has just now been on his feet in the House of Commons talking about the NHS, its preparedness to face the epidemic. He used that response to address the strike announcement.
It is clear from both the NHS and UKHSA data that there is a real risk for the NHS and for patients. And it is at this moment of maximum danger that the BMA has chosen to go ahead with Christmas strikes when it will inflict the greatest level of damage on the NHS. The BMA said this dispute was about pay, but we gave them a 28.9% pay rise. Then they said it was also about jobs, so I offered a deal to halve the competition for jobs to less than 2 applicants per post. It is now clear what these strikes are really about. The BMA's fantasy demand for another 26% pay rise on top of the 28.9% they have already received. I also offered to extend the BMA's strike mandate so they could postpone this action and go ahead once flu has subsided. The fact they also rejected that offer shows a shocking disregard for patient safety. Since this strike represents a different magnitude of risk to previous industrial action, I am appealing to ordinary resident doctors to ignore the BMA strike and go to work this week.
A shocking strike in pursuit of a fantasy demand. It was strong stuff, and I'm going to be talking to the Health Secretary a little later on. And meanwhile, the liaison committee at Westminster, a committee of senior MPs, the Prime Minister was asked how, well, gutted he was over the BMA's decision.
Very gutted.
Is that 10 out of 10?